You're listening to Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM.
Canada's premiers met in Victoria in mid-January to discuss changes to the healthcare system. In a pre-summit press conference last summer, BC Premier Christy Clark promoted activity-based funding as a way to drive down wait times for surgical procedures. This funding model will bring about a radical shift in how hospitals are allocated money from the provincial government. Marcy Cohen is lead author of a new report for the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives that takes a close look at activity-based funding. And Marcy Cohen joins me by phone this morning. Hello, Marcy.
Good morning.
Now, I said that the report takes a close look at activity-based fundings, but in fact, you have explored a couple of different funding models in the report. Can you tell me what they are?
Yes, actually, what we're doing here is looking at what the provincial government's doing in terms of two very different strategies for dealing with the current problems in the health system, and they're trying to go down both directions at once. And so what this paper looks at is those two different directions and evaluates them in terms of international literature. So let me just start by saying that we hear a lot of media coverage these days about problems with overcrowding in hospitals and wait lists and congestion, and that seems to be the overarching concern, is that we have too many people in hospitals who don't need to be there, and that's what's creating the long wait lists. And so what the provincial government has done is they've developed a strategic framework which says, on one hand, we need to integrate services and we need to do more in the community. On the other hand, it says that we need to introduce a new funding model in hospitals called activity-based funding. And unfortunately, they've really given most of the airtime and funding to the activity-based funding model, and what our research shows internationally is that that's not the way to solve the problems in the health system.
Well, let's take a closer look at activity-based funding. What exactly does that mean?
It means that instead of funding hospitals globally, as now is the case, that a certain portion of hospital funding will not be given to hospitals ahead of time, but will be based on the actual volume of procedures performed. And they're starting that with surgeries, and they're already doing it. So that the idea is that you're going to create more efficiency and activity because you're going to encourage hospitals to do more because they'll get paid if they do more activity, and they'd get paid less if they do less activity. So it's seen as an efficiency model to get more activity in the hospital so that to solve the problems of the wait lists.
So let me just make sure I have this clear. So it's encouraging the hospitals to do more surgery because in part their funding will depend on how many surgeries they do.
Right. And the way it works is that, you know, really the efficiencies are gained by putting people through faster and releasing them faster from hospitals. So having more day surgeries, having shorter lengths of stay.
So what's the downside to that?
Okay, well, this strategy has been tried in a number of different countries. And there's what is emerging is several problems with it. One is that although the focus of it is increased efficiency and cost savings, in fact, the evidence is in many cases it actually costs more. In terms of overall costs, because of the increased activity, and also because of the higher administrative costs, because with activity-based funding, there's an incentive for hospitals to try to upgrade the seriousness of a surgery because they get paid more for that. So there ends up having to be a new monitoring system on hospitals to check the fact that they're not doing it. Then there's also the costing procedure. Just without going into a lot of detail, there's a lot of administrative costs associated with activity-based funding. So the evidence that it saves costs is not clear. There's also a real risk around quality, and this relates to the fact that if you're encouraging volume, you're going to increase volume the most on the simplest procedures that are predictable. So it really is an incentive for over-treatment of some populations, of the very simple procedures that you know are going to happen without a lot of problems, and and a disincentive for more complicated procedures where it's more, less predictable, where you might run into some complexity. So people will have more serious disabilities. So there is lots of evidence that this is definitely a perverse incentive in activity-based funding, and that in some countries where they've introduced activity-based funding, they can show these kind of skews in terms of who gets served, an over-treatment of some populations, an under-treatment of people who have more disabilities, more complex needs.
Now, this reminds me of conversations I've had with people about the private sector entering the providing day surgeries, providing those surgeries that are easier to do. Is there an interrelationship there?
You're right. There is that the same kind of an incentive for private surgeries. The connection is a couple. One is that in the way that they're doing this in BC, they're really focusing on day surgeries. And day surgeries is something that private clinics can do as well as the public hospitals. That's under the Health Act. If a surgery is less than 24 hours, it can be done in a private clinic or a hospital. So in that case, it does potentially entrench private clinics more. The more dangerous and serious, insidious kind of marketization, I would call it, built into activity-based funding, is creating an internal market within the public system. So one of the ways that you reduce costs is you can create competition between hospitals to bid on doing surgeries. I can do so much volume for so much cost, and you try to drive down the price that way. And that kind of internal market has a number of disadvantages. Again, it privileges the less complex surgeries and less complex procedures. And two, it really works against what we know is the more effective strategy of improving wait times, and that is better collaboration, learning from best practices, working in teams. So there, we did a paper a few years ago from CCPA about public solutions to waitlist problems, which showed that when you work as a team, you do much better, and that there's really a lot of learning that should be happening from hospital to hospital, and the competition built into activity-based funding could really discourage that.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about the other model that you talk about in your paper, because you, as you said, you did research into communities that had different systems. What did you find out about another more integrative model of healthcare?
Okay, well, let me just step back a minute in terms of talking about that. And that is that when you look at the literature in terms of what is the reason why we have these overcrowding and waitlist problems in hospitals, there was a recent study done nationally by the Wait Time Alliance, the group that's looking at wait times, and they said the biggest reason why there's wait times is the number of people who are in hospital that don't really need to be there, but aren't able to get out of hospital because the palliative care, residential care, community health services aren't available. So it really is saying that the problems of the wait list and overcrowding in hospitals has to do with the deficiencies in the community health system, and that you can't solve it by activity-based funding. You really need to look at what's going on in the community. And so the systems, both in BC, in communities and up north that have done better, and internationally, are those that have really focused on more integration and better quality services in the community, particularly to support people with chronic conditions, frail elderly, people with mental illness. And interestingly, those systems have proved more cost-effective. For a number of reasons. One, that community services generally are less expensive, so if you can do things in the community that you would otherwise do in hospitals, it can be less expensive. But also because those systems really focus a lot on getting things right and on performance standards, and so it's the idea, and quality. And so the idea is that the quality costs less, that if you don't have readmissions and if you don't make mistakes, it's actually more cost effective. So it's a strategy that really has a lot of potential, but it requires a lot of commitment from a government to make systemic changes across the health system, and not these kind of magic bullet ideas like activity-based funding.
So who isn't working together now, if I could put it that way, who should be working together?
Yes, well, that's good to sort of kind of bring it down to the concrete. So right now, in the community, somebody has home support, has a chronic condition, needs some help with medications, they might have a home support worker looking after them. That home support worker has no connections with the person's family doctor. So they're the person who sees the person the most. They might notice some change in their health. They have very little way of connecting with back to the family physician and saying, you know, I think you need to see this person, or, you know, or the nurse, so that there is very little connection between the various services in the community. They all operate as what we call separate silos, and, you know, it would be much more effective if they worked in teams. And there's a little bit of that happening in some communities. So in some communities, they're beginning to put the home care nurses in physicians' offices, and for people who need more coordination and more tracking, those nurses are working with the physicians in that way. But it's only happening at this point in isolated pockets.
And where does the money saving come in that kind of system?
It comes in terms of reducing unnecessary hospital admissions. So we do much worse in Canada in terms of caring for people with chronic conditions in the community. People more often end up going to emergency, going into hospital, than they need to be. And if they were provided with better community and primary care, there would be less emergency visits and less hospitalizations. And that there's solid evidence of that both in BC and internationally.
Now, you say that BC is pursuing sort of two different routes on this. How much investment is it putting into each side? I don't know if that's a helpful way to look at it.
That is a really important way to look at it. So they are putting considerable provincial resources, $250 million, into the activity-based funding. They are putting literally no resources into the community side. So they're saying to the health authorities, you should do the integration, but they're not providing any new provincial funding to make that possible. There is a clear priority in terms of the funding that they're providing for the two initiatives.
And are there other jurisdictions in Canada that are pursuing this activity-based funding, or are we leading the way with this here in BC?
There's other jurisdictions that are looking at it. Quebec's looking at it. Ontario's looking at it. Alberta's looking at it in long-term care. We pride ourselves in leading the way on it. But, you know, it's interesting that countries like the UK and the US that have had activity-based funding for a long time, they're key policy leaders, some of the sort of most respected researchers and policy people from those countries are now saying that activity-based funding is actually standing in the way of integration, that it's really a problem. It's not just the wrong strategy. It actually works against the strategy that they need to put in place. And that's because it encourages activity in hospitals, the most expensive part of the system, and it only deals with that one part of the system. It isn't a funding model that looks at what happens to the patient across all the services they receive. And so they're arguing that what we need instead is a funding model where you can look at a patient's experience and hold people accountable across the system so that the care happens in the right place. And there are definite systems that do that, and that we need to move in that direction in BC and in Canada.
Well, I'll point people towards the report, Marcy, and they can take a look for themselves. It's a very interesting reading. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
I've been speaking with Marcy Cohen. She's lead author of the report, Beyond the Hospital Walls, and you can find that report at policyalternatives.ca.